This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of January the 19th, 2015. This podcast is presented by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. Any use of this presentation without the express written consent of Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated and your State Society of CPAs is prohibited. I'm Ed Zollers, and we're going to talk about some of the developments that took place over the past week in the area of federal income taxes. And we're going to start out first with Notice 2015-4. This is a definitional notice that came out for businesses that are looking to try to get a credit for certain solar wind energy property. Now, it's a very specific subclass. The credit's equal to the 30% of the basis of qualifying property. That property must be originally used by the taxpayer, constructed by the taxpayer, and must be subject to depreciation. It has to meet specific standards. Those standards that the IRS notes in this case are going to be either the American Wind Energy Association Small Wind Turbine Performance and Safety Standard 9.1-2009 or the International Electrotechnical Commission 61400-1, 61400-12, and 61400-11. The notice tells us that manufacturers will be able to certify, so that taxpayers can rely upon the certification, that their equipment meets these requirements. The IRS does have the right to examine the taxpayer in this case and take a look, not the taxpayer, I should say, but the manufacturer, and will be able to make a determination if the manufacturer certified something that was not qualified. But even if the IRS does so, anybody who purchased the equipment on or before the day the IRS concludes and publishes a notice that this manufacturer certification can no longer be relied upon, they'll still be able to rely upon and use it. Anybody acquiring after that date won't. The notice, not unexpectedly, then goes on and reminds manufacturers that if they certify something that does not qualify, they potentially could be subject to a number of penalties, presumably more significant penalties if they do so knowingly. So that would be one of our problems that we run into in this case. Next up is a question dealing with divorce, child support, and alimony. This is a case of Becker versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2015-2. The case was published on January the 13th, 2015. Now, Mr. Becker had a divorce agreement with his ex-spouse. He was to pay the ex-spouse a fixed amount of alimony and a fixed amount of child support each year. Mr. Becker was advised by his counsel that he could reduce his child support payment to his former spouse by amounts that he paid personally. He did so, plus, as it turns out, if you look at the facts of the case, went a bit beyond that. Originally on his return, he claimed a deduction on his return for the full amount he had paid. That is the amount, because he still had amounts that had not been paid by him that would have been required to be paid to his former spouse's alimony. So he deducted not only that part of the payments, but also the part that would have been alimony under his argument that he got to do an offset. And he claimed that because, of course, he'd been told that, his allocation should stand. Unfortunately, as the tax court points out, that Internal Revenue Code Section 71C3 provides that if a decree provides for a payment of both child support and alimony, and less than a total amount is paid, the first dollars to be paid are always to be deemed to be going against the child support portion of the payment, and only after that has been totally paid can any dollars after that be deemed alimony for deduction purposes. Since Mr. Becker had paid less than the total of the two amounts, we had to turn around and reduce from his total payments the amount that he paid out, that he was supposed to have paid out as child support, without in this case any reduction for those payments that he said, well, wait, I paid it personally. I paid amounts on behalf of the child. Court said, sorry, the agreement was very clear that you were supposed to pay dollars X to your former spouse. You did not, you know, we're going to reduce your payments by that, and only amounts in excess of that will be considered alimony. Now, Mr. Becker did have a CPA prepare his return, but he still got hit with the penalties because it turned out a couple of problems came up. Number one, he had claimed a deduction for the entire amount and never explained why that was reasonable, never really explained what he had relied upon in doing so with the CPA, or that CPA had been relied upon advice to do this. Therefore, he was merely the fact of having a CPA prepare his return was not sufficient to get him out of the penalties. Next up, 500 pages of reading materials came out on the 16th of January. Revenue Procedure 2015-13 and 2015-14. Effectively, they replace old Revenue Procedure 2011-14 and a number of other rulings that came after that date. Now, what was Revenue Procedure 2011-14? Revenue Procedure 2011-14 was the prior automatic change revenue procedure. That is, changes in accounting method a taxpayer could undertake that would automatically be granted by the IRS. In that situation, the taxpayer files a Form 3115 with the return and sends a copy of the 3115 to, technically the old ruling said, the national office, though many cases now they had redirected that to Ogden. These 3115s are big this year because of the new repair regulations that came in, effective for years beginning in 2014. Therefore, a bunch of 3115s are going to be filed this year. So these new procedures impact all of those filings under the repair regulations. What the IRS did in this case was previously Revenue Procedure 2011-14 contained a front part of the procedure that were basically the procedures for filing an automatic change, and then it had an appendix that had all of the automatic change procedures that were authorized and any special rules that applied to each one of them. What they've now done is broken this into two separate revenue procedures. 2015-13 contains the procedures that will be used by a taxpayer, and 2015-14 has all of the automatic changes listed. This notice also supersedes the old ruling 9727 that dealt with non-automatic changes. So this ruling will take over all changes of accounting method will be governed by this ruling. Now there are a number of changes that took place under this, although most of them are more, shall we say, nibbling at the edges changes, not necessarily anything hugely significant. We did roll in all of the repair regulation changes. Remember those from earlier in the year. We had three revenue procedures. Those three revenue procedures changes are now rolled into this overall revenue procedure. So 2015-14 now has the guidance for that. And basically, it is the same guidance we had before. The other quirk that came up, one change that was made, the IRS made official that automatic changes now, the copy of the 3115 goes to Ogden. No longer will automatic changes, unless specified directly, automatic changes always go to Ogden. So that's a difference from the old rule that said automatic changes, all changes went to the national office in D.C., and if only specified otherwise, did they go somewhere else. The IRS has apparently decided that the automatic changes should go to Ogden. Those that need some action will go to D.C. This takes effect for any request for accounting method change filed on or after January 16th of 2015. That means basically all the 3115s for the repair regulations are going to be filed under these new procedures. As I say, between the two of them, the way the IRS published them, they are close to 500 pages of guidance. Again, most of that deals with all the various automatic change procedures, which won't be relevant to you this year, because the larger one of the two by far is the second one that has the procedures listed. But you should be aware that the procedures have changed, they have moved, and presumably we'll get a new 3115 to go along with this because the IRS tends to update that when they update these rulings. So keep your eyes open. That's especially true for all of us that are working up these 3115s to file due to the repair regulation changes. Be aware the revenue procedure governing that has now been updated and changed. So it's something to keep your eyes on, as if you didn't have enough to do over the next few months dealing with the changes under the repair regs, we now have a whole new revenue procedure to deal with. Private Letter Ruling 2015-03005, issued on the 16th of January, shows that there are ways out of problems sometimes. In this case, an accountant had prepared the tax return for an individual. That individual had sold an asset on the installment basis. The accountant, when originally preparing the return, had mistakenly determined that it appears there was no tax. What the ruling tells us is there was no advantage to making the installment election, to filing on the installment basis, so the taxpayer went ahead and reported the entire gain on the tax return. The taxpayer, but we get with the later discussion per the taxpayer claims, the accountant and the accountant backs this up, didn't really ask the taxpayer if they wanted to elect out the installment basis. The tax preparer merely did so. Preparing the next year's return, the accountant discovered that, well, guess what? He had made an error in computing the tax due. And now this is even worse because now there is this error, and he discovers that, in fact, not having elected out of the installment basis was going to cost the taxpayer money, and secondly, as you might expect, was also going to accelerate all the tax into the prior year. At this point, the accountant and the taxpayer asked the IRS National Office for the right to make a late election, or essentially to revoke their election out of the in the installment basis. The regulations for installment basis elections tell us generally a taxpayer's request to undo the election will not be granted. However, in this case, the National Office decided that there was a true mistake of fact. It also was important that apparently in private letter ruling, they required the accountant and the taxpayer to state openly that the accountant had made this decision without consulting the taxpayer, and so the taxpayer was not aware of the election. That really put the accountant out there on a limb. The IRS not decided to grant this relief. And by doing so, though, the IRS agreed that the taxpayer could go back, use the installment basis of reporting on that amended return. As you might guess, it seems pretty obvious an amended return for the prior year was going to be due, and that the taxpayer would therefore be able to make use of the installment basis. Now, we have a couple of cases here toward the end that deal with the issue of the statute of limitations. In the first case, we are going to take a look at the case of Heartland Management Services versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2015-8. That was issued on January 12th of 2015. In this particular case, we have an exam running. And as we're all aware, when the IRS begins to come anywhere close to the expiration of the statute of limitation, the agent was going to ask you to grant the IRS a waiver of the statute. They're going to present a Form 872 for the taxpayer to sign. Now, as we all know, if the taxpayer says, no, I won't do that, because the taxpayer doesn't have to. The IRS has 3 years to assess the tax, and they need to get it done within that time frame. But if the taxpayer says no in that case, what the IRS does, as we all know, is they will turn around and basically assess every possible dollar of tax, generally greatly complicating the situation. So, not unexpectedly in this case, the advisor and the tax and the client decided that it would probably be best to grant this waiver. So the IRS prepares up the Form 872. In preparing the Form 872, the IRS made a mistake. In the portion of the 872 that asked for the taxable year ending for the statute to be extended, the IRS, instead of putting the year end in question, put in there instead the date the statute would have expired, meaning that we had an odd date, the 15th, middle of the month, sitting in there. And they had three different entities. They did it for all three. They had two entities plus the individual returns. All three got the same error that they put the expiration date instead of the taxable year into the block. The taxpayer and his advisor, we should say, who signed it, signed the extension agreement that had those erroneous dates on them. IRS continues the exam, eventually comes up with a proposed assessment, and as we're getting again close to the expiration of the close to the date that they previously allowed for the tax to be assessed, the IRS asked for another extension. This time, the taxpayer's advisor and attorney and CPA told the taxpayer not to sign the form. In fact, there was a big note on it, do not sign an X through it. The IRS contacted them, essentially was told that the taxpayer's position was the statute was closed because the previous Form 872 with those dates on it did not serve to extend the statute on the original return. IRS went ahead and assessed the tax. And, of course, the taxpayer then protested the tax court, claiming that, in fact, this is after the expiration of the statute and the IRS can't do this. The tax court, however, said, while the IRS generally is bound by the documents it prepares, if there truly was a mutual mistake of fact, then, in fact, what the parties intended rather than what was written is what should govern. The court found it unbelievable that an advisor with many years of experience didn't know what dates should have been in those boxes or didn't recognize it was somewhat unusual to have 315 dates in there for year ends. Presumably, in all those conversations, the advisor was aware of which years were asked to be extended, and the advisor made a consent based on that. Based on that concept, the tax court decided that that 872 could be basically reformed to put in the actual dates in there, and the taxpayer would be held to those dates because that was the actual agreement between the IRS and the taxpayer, even if that was not what was written in the agreement. Next statute one, Harper International Corp. This one looked a little different issue. The IRS had denied a refund claim. They issued a letter denying the claim. With about a month later, they issued a letter that repeated the denial, but said a formal denial was to come and the 2 years for filing a court case would run from them. Well, it turns out the IRS never issued that other form because apparently it would assume the author of the letter wasn't aware that the formal denial had already gone out a month earlier. The taxpayer finally filed his claim in the U.S. Court of Claims, basically just about 2 years after. He mailed it 1 day before 2 years after the second letter was sent, and it arrived at the tax court what was 2 years and 4 days after that second letter was sent. The Court of Claims held two things. Number one, the Court of Claims held generally that second letter didn't override the first. The IRS made no claim they made a mistake. They made no formal withdrawal. So that initial denial was the one that would normally start the two-year statute. But the court held even if that didn't start it, the second letter would. And the second letter came out on June 5th. The taxpayer had mailed their petition to the Court of Claims on June 4th. Now, normally, you'd think, wait, mailed on June 4th, postmarked June 4th, that's fine, we're within the time period. But the Court of Claims points out that those rules only apply in tax court and for documents to the IRS. A filing with the Court of Claims has to get to the court by the due date. And in this case, they held it didn't get there. Therefore, even if they accept that that letter may be used as the real denial, then they were still too late in filing the form. Finally, we have the American Airlines versus Commissioner case. This is 144 TC number 2. Now, this case is unusual in many ways, but it has one interesting ruling that's in here. It involves South American employees of American Airlines that they had effectively taken over long, long ago when they took over the South American routes of the old Eastern Airlines, as some of you may remember. In 1992 to 1996, an exam was made regarding whether those individuals who the American was treating as employees of the South American countries, whether there were some payroll taxes or some withholding money otherwise that was due on those amounts paid. Appeals finally got involved in this, and appeals decided that that old 1976 Revenue Act, Section 530, should apply. 530 of the old Revenue Act says, of course, if you had always consistently treated someone as an employee and had a reasonable basis for doing so, and you'd issued all required documents, that in fact the IRS essentially could not reclassify these people or, you know, collect payroll taxes on them. Now, that appeals ruling also said that the IRS agreed that they would not enter into any questions about this until after 2002, so they were blessed for then. 2003, the service shows back up. 2003, 2006, we have another exam going, same basic issue. But this time the IRS argued, they said, wait, we're not saying they were employees. We're saying that regardless, because American says they're employees, they just said they weren't U.S. people to be taxed. And we're saying, no, they're subject to tax under one of two mechanisms as U.S., the U.S. income portion. And they said because of that, 530 wasn't involved because no determination of whether someone was employee was involved. American Airlines said, no, there was a 530 issue involved. Why is that important? The tax court generally wouldn't have jurisdiction over a payroll tax matter unless the matter is 530 because Congress granted them the right to review 530. The tax court decided that, unlike what the IRS had said, two things. First, they said there did not have to be a payroll determination that people were employees, nor did the question of whether somebody is an employee have to be in play. Rather, as long as there was a dispute involving 530, which there was because appeals had said 530 caused this to not be taxable to American. Because of that dispute, that meant the tax court had jurisdiction. They also rejected the IRS's view that regardless of anything, unless the IRS made an employment jurisdiction determination, that 530 could not apply. The tax court ruled again that as long as there is a 530 issue in play, the tax court retains jurisdiction. Thus, the tax court will be able to hear American Airlines' challenge regarding a potential payroll tax a payroll tax liability imposed on the South American employees. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for January 19, 2015. Please be sure to join us next week as we go through another week's updates of what's been going on in the tax law.